Hey guys, it's Elena.
And it's Candace.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime. How are you, Candace?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Just came out of church service, so feeling refreshed.
Okay, hallelujah.
Yes, thank you, Jesus.
Yeah, and let's talk about some murder. What is your case? I texted you really late last night. I don't know why I had this weird feeling like, what if we were doing the same case?
Yeah, I've wondered that too before. Like, I think the last week I was like, wouldn't that be funny?
Yeah.
But yeah, and I was, when I got your text, I was like, oh, she's up late.
I was, and I had nightmares because I was like used to in the early days, we used to text each other and be like, oh my gosh, you're never going to believe this case, like blah, blah, blah. And now it's like, ooh, so secretive.
Yes, the suspense.
Okay, I'm really excited to hear your case.
Well, this case was brought to my attention by our auntie, or if you're fancy, auntie. It's based in Oklahoma, but there is a series on Hulu about it, so y'all may have already heard about it. And I'll tell you the name of that series at the end.
Ooh, gotta wait.
So if you have already heard about it, hopefully I can shed light on more information for you. This does involve three little girls. So if you don't want to listen, now is your time to exit. So this is the story about the murders of Lori Farmer. She was 8. Doris Denise Milner, who was 10. And Michelle Gusey, who was 9. Also known as the Girl Scout murders, as well as the Camp Scott murders. Have you heard?
Is this about the camp?
Yes, the Girl Scout camp.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Other people who I've kind of talked to over the last few days says they haven't heard about it, but most true crime enthusiasts probably have heard about it. So Lori, she was a bright girl who skipped second grade. She loved her younger siblings. She was the oldest of 5. She liked gymnastics and reading. In a report with the Oklahoman, her father recalled when Lori was 16 months old, she could recite the Pledge of Allegiance flawlessly.
Aww.
And she could do a 100-piece jigsaw puzzle at the age of 2.
Wow.
Yes. She seems very smart. She wasn't actually that involved in Girl Scouts, but she did want to go to Girl Scout camp, and she was the youngest Girl Scout at the camp. Michelle Gusey was athletic and shy and loved plants. African violets were her favorite, or one of her favorites. She was familiar with Camp Scott as a returning camper. Her mother talked about how Michelle sat on her lap and told her parents she was going to miss them and made sure that her mother would take care of her plants.
Oh.
Denise Milner was a straight-A student, and she had already been admitted into a Tulsa school that was created for exceptionally bright students. She loved to watch TV and play with her younger sister. She was excited about going to camp. She worked and sold enough Girl Scout cookies to be able to go. And then at the last minute, Denise's friends backed out. But she reluctantly went without them, and just before leaving, she told her mom, I don't really want to go, but her mom encouraged her to go and told her, but if I need to come pick you up, you just let me know.
Mm.
but at least try. Camp Scott was a 410-acre property located between Locust Grove and Tahlequah, Oklahoma, and was open since 1928.
Wow.
So lots of fun was had by the Girl Scouts at this venue over the years. On June 12th of 1977, about 140 Girl Scouts from the area of Tulsa, Oklahoma, arrived at Camp Scott. Lori, Denise, and Michelle shared tent number 8 in the camp's Kiowa unit, which was located the farthest from the camp counselor's tent and partially hidden by the shower building. The tent was the only tent that the camp counselor did not have a good visual of from her tent. And the tents were actually made up of a wooden platform and frame with it was A-framed with a canvas fabric on top and draped down. So it's not like the Girl Scouts had to go and set up their own tents. They were already prepared. Yeah. At around 7 p.m. that night, a thunderstorm hit the area, and the girls ate, got settled, and huddled in their tents. The three girls in tent number 8 wrote letters to their families telling about their day, and I'll read you what each of their letters said.
Aww.
So Lori's letter, it says, "Dear Mom and Dad, and Misty, and Joe, and Chad, and Kathy. We are just getting ready for bed. It's 7:45. We are at the beginning of a storm and having a lot of fun. I've met 2 new friends, Michelle Gusey and Denise Milner. I'm sharing a tent with them. It started raining on the way back from dinner. We're sleeping on cots. I couldn't wait to write. We're all writing letters now because there's hardly anything to do. With love, Lori."
Oh, so sweet.
I know. Denise's letter says, "Dear Mom, I don't like camp. It's awful. The first day it rained, I have 3 new friends named Glenda, Lori, and Michelle. Michelle and Lori are my roommates. Mom, I don't want to stay at camp for 2 weeks.
Oh.
I want to come home and see Cassie and everybody. Your loving child, Denise Milner."
Oh, what a little angel.
I know, your loving child. I just love that. Michelle's letter says, "Dear Aunt Karen, how are you? I'm fine. I am writing from camp. We can't go outside because it's raining. Me and my tent mates are in the last tent in our unit. My tent mates are Denise Milner and Lori Farmer. My room is in shades of purple. Love, Michelle."
Oh, what a sweet... Like, these are just totally little kid letters. Like, we're all letters right now. We are the last
There's
tent.
There's nothing to do.
It's like...
Yes.
Bless.
But back in the day, that's what we had to do.
Exactly.
Write letters or tell ghost stories.
Yeah.
But in the middle of the night, one of the counselors, Carla Wilhite, heard what she described as a guttural moaning sound. She got up to check it out and heard the noise coming from the wooded area. She walked over and shined her flashlight into the woods, and the sound stopped. As soon as the flashlight was not shining into the woods anymore, the sound started back up. Carla turned around and started walking toward the sound again, and the sound stopped. She said it wasn't human, but it wasn't animal. She started to get a little nervous and figured it was just an animal, so she went back to bed. She said that as she was trying to fall back asleep, she could still hear the moaning sound.
Ugh.
Other little girls, other campers there, I guess as they were interviewed, said that they had heard noises through the night. Actually, a little girl in tent 7 said that she had seen a figure of a man with a flashlight open their tent.
Oh.
But then he walked, yeah, but then he went, walked away and left. Uh-uh. So, at around 6 a.m. in the morning on June 13th, Carla was making her way to the shower when she came upon a heart-wrenching scene. She saw a girl's body partially on her sleeping bag in a wooded area close to the tent area. At first, she thought the girl was just sleeping, but quickly realized that she was deceased, and upon further inspecting, found that there were three bodies laying there deceased. Counselors began searching the tents and found that the three girls from tent number 8 were missing, and determined that the three girls that were murdered were all from tent number 8. Two bodies were found in a sleeping bag, and the third body was visible on the ground. They had been left on a trail leading to the showers about 150 yards from the tent. So think the length of a football field and a half away from their tent. So police were called, and they announced that evidence strongly indicated that the girls were attacked in their tent while sleeping. They were bound with cord and tape. They were sexually assaulted and then taken from the tent and left in the woods. Testing showed that they had been bludgeoned and strangled. Oof. A large red flashlight was found near the bodies. The flashlight seemed to be reconstructed. There was tape and green plastic around the end of it as if to hide the light or make it only shine enough for the person holding it to see, and dim the light so that others couldn't see it from a distance. Yeah. Also, inside the flashlight, there was a piece of newspaper wadded up as if to hold the battery in place and not let it clank around.
Interesting.
It's like the flashlight was like one of those big box flashlights.
Yeah. Think of
1977. Mm-hmm. So the newspaper that was wadded up was from the Tulsa World newspaper and dated April 17th, 1977.
Wow.
A smudged fingerprint was found on the lens, but it never has been identified as it was too smudged for a positive identification. The back of the tent of tent number 8 was cut. Blood was found in the tent along with a size 9.5 shoe print in the blood. In another area away from the bodies, police found a crowbar and three beer bottles.
Jeez.
There was a local rancher, Jack Schroff. His ranch was located within a mile from the camp. And he told police that food was stolen from his home along with tape, beer, rope, and three crowbars. And the rope was similar to that found on the bodies.
Oh my God.
I don't recall him saying when the burglary from his ranch happened, but a command post was set up at the property. Over 100 people were interviewed. A squirrel hunter came across a cave in the area. One of the most significant things in the cave found was a newspaper, which was the Tulsa World newspaper dated April 17th, 1977. It matched the newspaper in the flashlight.
Jeez.
Same section and correlated with the page that was in the flashlight.
Like a cave?
Yeah, I think they said there was like three or four caves that they found in the area. And I want to say they said it was about 4 miles from the camp, if I'm not mistaken, but close to. A pair of eyeglasses and its case was found. A camp counselor came forward and claimed that the glasses belonged to her and had been missing. A roll of tape along with two pictures of two different women were found. A red and black pair of panties, adult size.
Those are mine.
And human feces.
Not the feces, but the panties.
Oopsie. Sorry, guys. A note was found written on the cave wall. It said, "The killer was here. Bye-bye, fools."
What? Ew.
Yeah. Conflicting reports. There was, another report said that the note in the cave said, "I am the killer," and had the date of the murder. So, regardless, we know the killer was there. Mm-hmm. Investigators determined that the cave was on or close to the land that was owned by Ella May Buckskin. And she was the mother of a man named Jean Leroy Hart. The photographs found in the cave were said to have been developed by Jean Hart while he served time in the Granite Reformatory. When he was there, he was able to help a photographer develop film. This photographer would come in and take pictures of the inmates, or like when the inmates had weddings or things like that. So yeah. Jean was able to help him develop that film. And the photographer told police that he did take pictures of those two women. And Jean must have stolen them from the negatives.
Wow.
So let me tell you a little bit about Jean. In June of 1966, Jean Hart, a member of the Cherokee Nation and a native to Locust Grove, had abducted and sexually assaulted two pregnant women from a nightclub in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Gross.
So these women, they were 18 and 19 years old. They were somewhere around 3 months pregnant at the time. He bound them with cord and tape, just like the three Girl Scouts. He tried on their eyeglasses. And then he tried on their eyeglasses. I mean,
what?
Sounds kind of like a little fetish, but I'll get into that here in a little bit. When he was done with them, he just left them laying there. He buried them, put a little bit of debris on them, and left them for dead. One of the women was able to break loose out of her bindings, and after he left, and she was able to help the other girl out of hers, and they both survived.
Wow.
They were able to identify him, and he ultimately pled guilty to the crimes. He served 2.5 years.
What?
And was eventually let out on parole.
What?
Yeah, I think he was sentenced to, I want to say, 20 or 30 years for those crimes, but only served 2.5, and they let him out on parole.
I hate it.
Yeah. The next June, he burglarized a female policewoman's home. Well, she was there at the same time, and she held him at gunpoint and called police, and he was arrested again.
He picked the wrong house.
For the burglary. Yeah.
Idiot.
So, yeah, he was arrested again for the burglary and breaking parole. In 1973, he had escaped, and he was still on the loose when the murders happened in 1977, 4 years later.
So they just were like, oh, well, he escaped. I mean, were they looking for him? Or?
They did look for him, but their efforts were not fruitful.
Okay.
Fruitful.
Because he was in a cave.
Fruitful. Right. And, I mean, he stayed in the area.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of mention that he had a lot of support in the area.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were hiding him out.
Why?
He was Native American, and at this time in the 70s, you know, Native Americans, they didn't really trust the justice system. Mm-hmm. And he was family to a lot of them, honestly.
Yeah.
So they were hiding him out. But when he had escaped, another inmate named Larry Dry escaped with him. And Larry was quickly apprehended and gave investigators details of how they were going about while on the run. He gave information about a flashlight they would use, much like the one that was found at the scene at Camp Scott, telling investigators that he would dim the light so only he would be able to see. Mm-hmm. He also mentioned that Jean Hart would always steal eyeglasses because he had poor eyesight.
Oh.
So, the eyeglasses found in the cave. Uh-huh. He tried on the pregnant girl's eyeglasses. So, yes, that was one of his little tendencies.
Strange. I mean, it's weird that he never, like, took them and kept them.
It didn't say anything about if he kept one of the girls' eyeglasses. It just said he tried them on.
Yeah.
But a lot of burglaries, he took the glasses. Oh. There was eyeglasses reported missing. And, like, the Girl Scout had her eyeglasses missing. Uh-huh. So he did take some, I guess, some that fit his, you know, prescription. Yeah. Another informant told police they had stayed in a cave with Gene Hart after committing a burglary with him.
Hmm.
So this was not looking good for him.
Yeah.
In April of 1978... the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation found and arrested Gene Hart. He was staying at the home of a Cherokee medicine man in Cookson Hills, about 45 miles away from Camp Scott. In that home, they found a mirror and other items that were reported missing from Camp Scott.
Wow.
Attorneys would later claim that these items were planted to frame Gene Hart. When arrested, one of Gene's only comments was, "You'll never pin it on me."
Okay.
So real quick, going back to the size 9.5 shoe print in the blood, Gene was a size 11 shoe.
Oh.
But in my mind, he was a scavenger, so if he's stealing things,
yeah,
he could have stolen whatever shoes he could find, whether they fit or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, 9.5, 11, he might have stuffed his feet in there. I don't know. Probably uncomfortable, but would protect his feet nonetheless.
Well, if they were like older, worn out shoes, probably more room in there.
Right. The community of Locust Grove, as I said earlier, knew Gene and most was related to him, so they would provide a place to stay for him. They supported him as he was going through the trial. There was a lot of protesting at the courthouse while these poor families were going through this murders, you know, the murders of their children. And they have all these locals with signs saying he's innocent, and he may have been, but we'll get into that as well. So at that time, as I said, the Native American population did not trust the justice system, and they questioned if Gene was arrested because of his heritage.
And they probably didn't believe, like, his past offenses either. If they were hiding him out and, you know, they must have felt like he was innocent of those charges too, because,
yeah,
you know,
who knows? The people who knew him said that Gene could never have done anything like this, even though he had confessed and pled guilty to the rape of the other two women. I don't get it. It's reported that people in town would go up to one of the girls' mothers and said, "I don't think Gene Hart killed your daughter."
Oh no.
Isn't that gross?
Not appropriate.
Like, why do we insert our unwanted or unwarranted advice and ignorant? Why do we say ignorant things like that?
No.
Not okay. There were tip jars at local restaurants asking for money to support Gene Hart.
Oh, no. So it became like he was the victim.
Right. Exactly. The state tried to get the trial moved to a different county, but that motion was denied. Gene's attorney called a witness to the stand at the trial. It was a cellmate of his, and that backfired on Gene. The cellmate ended up telling the jury that one day he had asked Gene if he killed the three girls. And Gene's response to him was, "I don't know. I woke up in a cave and blood was all over me."
Oh.
And Gene's attorney was furious. He yelled out in the courtroom,
"Don't say that.
You're supposed to be on our side." Yeah. Like, I don't know what he yelled out, but his past convictions were not allowed into this trial.
Wow.
And
I hate when they do that.
I do too, because the jury found him not guilty and acquitted Gene of all murder charges on March 30th of 1979.
Mm-mm-mm.
So this case remains open, and unsolved. However, they did take Gene back into custody to finish out the remainder of his sentence from his previous convictions that he escaped from 4 years ago. He had 305 years left to serve.
Oh my gosh.
About 2 months later in June of 1979, Gene was jogging inside of the Oklahoma State Penitentiary in McAlester, Oklahoma.
Oh.
And he had a heart attack and he died at the age of 35 years old.
Bye.
So a lot of answers, I feel like, are gone with him. A lot of the investigators are 1,000% sure that it's him as the killer. And with him went a lot of answers. In 1989, a DNA sample from a semen stain on a pillowcase, as well as a strand of hair, was sent for testing and a partial profile was obtained. The hair had microscopic similarities to Gene. They were not able to exclude Gene from being a contributor, but it wasn't definitive either. Mm-hmm. So back in 1989, it was... You know, DNA testing was fairly new.
Yeah.
There were at least three other men that I could find in reports that were suspects that had criminal backgrounds, but investigators said that they were able to exclude every suspect except for Gene Hart. In 2008, more DNA testing was performed and showed a partial female DNA profile. Experts were able to confirm that the DNA did not belong to two of the victims, but they could not exclude the possibility that that the DNA could belong to the third victim. The report didn't say which girls were excluded or not.
Did they say where that DNA was found?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, the only DNA testing that I have seen that they've tested is the semen stains on the pillowcase and the hair, and then there was semen in and on their bodies. So there has been speculation that there may have been a female other than the three girls present at the time of the murders, but never confirmed. Hmm. Let me also point out that the semen on the bodies lacked sperm, indicating that the killer most likely had a vasectomy.
Oh.
Guess who had a vasectomy?
Was it Mr. Hart?
Gene Hart. Mm-hmm. In May of 2022, authorities announced more DNA tests had been performed through the years that strongly suggested Gene's involvement. However, officially, the results are to be deemed inconclusive as no full DNA profile has ever been developed in the case. Again, it was said that the test eliminated several other suspects, but could not fully eliminate Gene Hart. So I think this tells us that there's not been a lack of trying to get answers.
Yeah.
But, I mean, think about it. By this time, the DNA samples are old and degraded and probably difficult to test on.
I remember.
Especially if they've tested on it several.
Yeah, I remember when this last bit of information came out in 2022. And it was really exciting and, like, pretty promising, like, in his direction. So.
Right.
It just, like you said, it's not like they just said, okay, well, Gene Hart's dead. And we're pretty sure he did it. It's like they still have been trying this whole time.
Yeah. Yes. And the investigators have gotten really close with the victims' families, especially Lori Farmer's parents. And Lori's parents have been very active in keeping the case open. And so, yes, I think it's great that they're still trying to, I mean, I say give closure, but how do you really have closure from this? It just answers.
Yeah.
It helps. Mm-hmm. Something else to mention is earlier in the spring in April of 1977, the same year as the murder, a camper returned to her tent to find that some of her belongings were taken along with some donuts, and a note was left in her tent. It stated, "We're on a mission to kill three girls."
What?
Conflicting reports also say that the note said, "We're going to kill three people in tent number one." So, nevertheless, what it said, the threat was real. There had also been burglaries at the camp dining hall around April, and these warnings were ignored and assumed to be a prank.
Oh.
In 2010, there was an interview on VoicesOfOklahoma.com done with Nancy McDonald, who was on the council of the Magic Empire of Girl Scouts. She talks about the changes that came to Camp Scott and the organization. Nancy said that she immediately wanted Camp Scott closed and vowed to never open it again. She felt that they did need to have something open for the Girl Scouts to do, so they offered a day camp. They had the support of the Tulsa United Way that bused the girls every day to Camp Tall Chief for the camping experience, but the girls never stayed overnight.
Yeah, no.
No. The board added a security system and worked with the Oklahoma State Legislature to upgrade camping standards, which were then adopted by the American Camping Association to include security in all camping experiences for children. Nancy says that she and the board have definitely learned from this experience and will not take the warning signs lightly again.
I'd say.
She said, "We had gone through comprehensive training on safety for girls, safety in camps, and safety in camping experience. So everything that we knew we had done, in my opinion, correctly. But this experience moves you to another level. And so you have to learn from this experience. Incredible tragedy as it was. And my commitment was to make some changes." So
it's sad that three people had to die. Like, you can take all the safety measures you want, but they were in their tent asleep. Like, it was nighttime.
Yeah.
They weren't, it's not like they were wandering around and, you know, it's like, what do
yeah,
you,
exactly.
What safeguard can you do?
There was no fence
yeah.
around the campsite to, you know, I think there was a gate at the front, but I think they locked it, but there was no guards.
Yeah.
I mean, but a gate isn't going to keep a bad
no.
guy out. A fence, you know, they need a fence around anyway.
And there were no counselors, like, monitoring the kids at night, like, taking shifts?
So Carla Wilhite... taking shifts, there were several camp counselors. They were young.
Yeah.
And I think Carla was just out of age to be a Girl Scout, so she
wow.
couldn't actually be there to attend camp. So she was now a counselor. And so, I mean, mm-hmm. yeah, she may have had training and everything, but she said she did get up in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she was listening for sounds, but what is she to do
mm-hmm.
by herself?
Yeah.
She could have got other counselors to help or figure out what was going on. There a lot have could have been done to change the situation, but we unfortunately.
But it's also there, like
it wasn't, and so
he obviously had been on property multiple times.
Yeah,
and he was familiar with the area.
You know, April.
He knew how to get in and out and around. Mm-hmm. And if there's no boundaries.
It was his childhood. Yeah. Born and raised in the area. And so, and obviously he had been there at least since April that year. I mean, the newspaper says mm-hmm. April. The prank that they thought was a prank happened in April. So this was premeditated.
Oh, yeah.
He was planning this.
Yeah.
But Bo and Sherry Farmer, Lori's parents, have been very active in keeping the case open, as I said. They have been activists in the justice system and getting certain laws approved for cases like theirs. They also founded the Oklahoma chapter of parents for or of murdered children. Also, Richard Gusey, Michelle's father, helped the state legislature pass the Oklahoma Victim Bill of Rights. He also chaired the Oklahoma Crime Victims Compensation Board. If you want to know more about the case, there was a book written in 1981 called Someone Cry for the Children. And that was made into a documentary in 1993. And going back to May of this year, Hulu came out with the docuseries called Keeper of the Ashes. It features Kristen Chenoweth. She's a Broadway star who is from Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, close to the area. And she talks about how she was supposed to attend Camp Scott that same week as the murder. But she got sick and she couldn't go. Sherry Farmer said that they have been asked several times to do either a documentary, a movie, or a book, but they have been very careful on what they've chosen to agree to. They've said no many times when being asked to do the Keeper of the Ashes documentary, but the more they got to know the people, they seemed extremely professional and caring. So she said, we just decided as a family that maybe this was the time to do it.
Yeah.
The name of the series comes from a tradition that they did at camp. At the end of each camp, one of the girls would become the keeper of the ashes from the last bonfire.
Aww.
So, did you watch this docuseries, Candace?
You know, I started watching it and I really didn't like how involved Kristen Chenoweth was in the documentary. I got a lot of vibes that she was more important than she was. I mean, like, it kind of came off as she kind of overshadowed the victims a little bit. And then, like, when she sang at the end of it, I was like, bye.
I mean, oh, no. See, I didn't watch it. Yeah. I didn't want to watch it because I didn't want it to be based on that docuseries. But the reports and things that I've read about it, it seemed, and I'm not trying to talk bad about it or say anything bad about Kristen Chenoweth, but yeah, it seemed like it was more about her.
It but felt
I don't
like
know.
That.
I didn't watch it. So.
And I didn't, I got a cringiness from that. And I think it did a good job of giving facts. You know, giving the facts and the case and, like, how the girls were found and everything. But I feel like it just kept coming back to her because she hosted it. I mean, she was, like, the narrator of it.
Yeah.
And so there were parts where she was, like, walking in the halls at school because she went to school with one of the girls. And she was like, this is where, you know. And I don't know. I just got this vibe. I'm like, it's not about you.
Yeah.
It's about the victims. And so I maybe
I'm
they
glad I'm not
trying
the only one that got that vibe.
Yeah, maybe they kind of missed that. They were trying to make it a little more, I don't know, they wanted more people to know about the case, so they tried to get a, you know, her and her story and how she almost went to camp and but it kind of came off as she was a little more important than she, like, the role she had in the whole thing, so.
Gotcha. Well, and she did say this case really affected her in her life.
I can
because,
imagine.
I mean, she was supposed to be there.
Yeah.
And she knew the people. So, yeah, I get that. But,
yeah,
I see what you're saying, because I thought that, too.
I have, you know, a situation where, and this is a case that we'll cover at some point, but the Wedgwood Baptist shooting, I was invited to go with her that night, and I had already told you that I'd go to church with you, and I mean, that certainly does affect a person that you
absolutely
one decision, and I know she got sick, and that's thankful. Like, thank God she got sick.
Because
the impact of her life would have been so much different had she actually been there. And who knows? She may have, like, wanted to be in that tent because she knew one of the girls. She went to school with her, so.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, as I said earlier, there are a lot of reports and such on this case. There are a few YouTube videos of people walking through the deserted camp, and that'll give you more of a perspective on how the camp was set up. I'm sure, did they do a walkthrough on the Keeper of the Ashes?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I will end by saying, life is hard. We go through hard things that are meant to help us grow and learn from. I mean, we go through trials and tribulations, but it builds our character. Are you going to let those hardships make you or break you? I just say that to say I think that it's powerful when victims can take a tragedy and make it into something meaningful. And I really think these families really have.
Mm-hmm. I just cannot imagine. I think even after all this time, they're still, you know, very involved, like you said, in the murdered children.
45 years later.
Yeah, it's amazing to me. It really is.
Yeah, I didn't want to do something that's popular with lots of reports out there, but Aunt Gerianna wanted more information on it. So do you think there's anything else in the documentary that I missed, or was there something else that I didn't cover, do you think? Do you recall?
I think you did a good job of telling the story, because there's a lot of stuff that I didn't know about, like some of the details, like the cave. I've never heard about that part. I didn't know about the newspaper linkage there, like from the flashlight and then the cave. Like, I didn't know that part either, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, good. I
felt like I
gave
was hearing
more a brand
new story. Good job, Lena.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, good. I'm glad.
Good.
All right. Well, that's all I've got. So,
all right.
Yeah, that was great. Let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, let's do it again next week. Thanks for listening.
Hope y'all have a good one.
Bye now.
Bye, y'all.